This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. It is the largest refugee crisis since World War II. Since the start of the civil war in Syria 4 years ago, millions of Syrian refugees have fled their home country, spilling into Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, and Europe. It's hard to miss the terrible pictures of displaced families sleeping in fields and along highways, and the bodies of those who've died trying to cross the Mediterranean in flimsy rubber boats. As Europe grapples with this crisis, some are asking, what more can and should America do? Secretary of State John Kerry has said the U.S. will begin to accept up to 100,000 refugees worldwide annually over the next few years. 15,000 could be Syrian. Even then, approval for resettlement can take anywhere from a year and a half to 2 years. Here to shed some light on the U.S. response is Jonah Eaton, a staff attorney at the Nationality Service Center in Philadelphia, where he specializes in asylum. Welcome, Jonah.
Thank you for having me.
And Kathleen Newland is senior fellow and co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute, where her work focuses on refugee protection and the governance of international migration. Welcome to you as well, Kathleen.
Pleasure to be with you.
So I'd like to start with some news headlines. The European Union has approved a plan to distribute 120,000 refugees across Europe. Hungary, Romania, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic voted no, but it seems as if at least some of these refugees will end up in countries which don't want them. Kathleen, first to you, was this a prudent move by the EU, and what sort of reception will they receive, do you think?
Well, I think it's a step that the EU sort of had to take at this point, really, to demonstrate to its members that being part of the European Union means accepting responsibilities as well as benefits. And the Eastern European countries that voted against the refugee distribution plan have benefited enormously from EU funds and from the free trade area and free movement of their people to work in other countries of Europe. And I think the majority of the European states feel that this point just has to be made, that solidarity is a two-way street.
Still, what will the refugees receive in terms of a welcome or not as they enter these countries?
Well, I'm sure they will not receive a warm welcome from the governments, but I think there's certainly members of the public in those countries that will welcome refugees, and you know, one hopes that they will be able to prevail. There are indeed some Muslim communities in those countries, although they are very small, but the numbers of refugees being resettled will also be small. And there will be some welcoming communities, although I feel that the government will not assist that, and I'm sure there are right-wing parties that will try to take advantage of it as a wedge issue.
Jonah, European Union leaders are meeting to talk about measures to try to decrease the flood of people entering Europe. From your perspective, what are their options?
Their options are not great. So there's obviously the root cause of this is the complete catastrophe in Syria, and that is very much what is driving the crisis. You've got many millions of people who are responding very rationally to some terrifically terrible situation. So I think until the underlying problem, which is the ongoing civil war, is resolved, people are going to keep on coming to Europe and sort of voting with their feet, as it were. I think that the steps the EU has taken, they've definitely taken some positive ones in recent couple weeks after sort of a somewhat dithery response in the first half of this year. But I think Germany's shown some impressive leadership. And the idea that Europe's going to start actually resettling, which is something Europe traditionally has not done very much of. It's mostly been something the U.S. has long been the leader in refugee resettlement. The fact that they're going to start resettling is also a very positive step. So I think that, they're not great options, but I think this is a necessary and a positive response.
Germany has said it can take in as many as 500,000 refugees a year for the next few years. How can Germany handle this?
Well, I mean, you have to remember that, you know, those numbers sound big, but, you know, Germany is the most populous country in Europe. I don't have the German population at my fingertips here, but, you know, we're talking, you know, what, over 100 million people. So, you know, it's a large population that can absorb that. There's also, I think, some distinctions to be made. Some of these numbers can get a little bit confused. So Germany has sort of internally signaled that what they actually expect is the first number was 800,000, and now maybe they're up to 1 million. That was actually, they're talking about asylum applicants. So those are people who are going to be admitted into Germany to sort of go through the asylum application process. They're not being given permanent status. They're not being given citizenship or even long-term visas. The other thing Germany has done that is very positive is they suspended what's known as the Dublin Regulation, which is they suspended Dublin processing, which is a sort of European Union-wide it's an EU law, it's a regulation that basically specifies where people have to apply for asylum. To take a simpler example, we have a similar deal with Canada. So between the U.S. and Canada, if you go to Canada first and then come to the U.S. and try to apply for asylum, the U.S., barring certain situations, can send you back to Canada and vice versa. If you come to the U.S. and try to go to Canada, the Canadians can send you back to the U.S. So the EU had that deal among all 28 member states. What that meant effectively is that the sort of the border states and the Mediterranean states were having to deal with all of the incoming migrants because they were walking into Italy first, Spain, Hungary, etc. Yeah. And then under Dublin rules, if they sort of made their way north, those countries would then send them right back, which is also, you know, there's more bureaucracy involved in that. So Germany has taken leadership in basically saying that they're not, you know, they're no longer giving these applicants sort of the Dublin questionnaire that they'd have to fill out, and they're letting them stay in Germany. It doesn't mean, though, that they're giving all those people, you know, any kind of permanent status.
But immediately, what is available to them in terms of shelter and work?
That is going to vary by EU country. So the EU tends to be, EU countries generally tend to be provide a lot more upfront in terms of basic social services for asylum applicants. Oftentimes, countries will run reception centers. You know, you have asylum applicants who will – they'll be housed and fed, which is something we do not do here in the States. It's very hard for – it's a very hard life for an asylum applicant here in the U.S. One difference, though, is that in the U.S., it's and this sort of reflects, I think, different kind of philosophies, is that after 6 months as an asylum applicant here, you can apply for employment authorization. So in the EU, again, it varies by EU country, but they tend to be much more protective of their labor markets. So in some cases, you're sort of stuck in these reception centers for years while your case is being processed and you can't work, you can't go to school. I mean, you're just sort of in this weird kind of legal limbo and your life goes on hold.
And Jonah, I'd like to get to the U.S. role in full in just a moment. But first, Kathleen, it's one thing to watch this story unfold on television or online and to try to get a sense of the misery the migrants are experiencing. It's another thing to hear it from someone who's seen this firsthand. And my understanding is that you've been to a refugee camps, most recently in Jordan. Describe what day-to-day life is like for the people who inhabit them.
Well, it is a state of limbo. And although the services in these camps are inadequate, they are enough to sort of keep people, housed and fed. But I think the overwhelming frustration in refugee camps is that there's no future. And in most camps, the education for children is extremely inadequate. This is something that matters a great deal, particularly to Syrians, which are, you know, an almost universally literate population with a high level of culture and so on. So I think there's tremendous frustration even once people's basic needs are met, which, you know, can take quite a long time in the midst of a refugee emergency, but it's not going to satisfy people. You go to the Zatri camp in Jordan now, and it's like a small city. I mean, there are businesses, there are schools, although very inadequate. There is life, but it's extremely limited and very frustrating for the people who live there. People aren't able to practice their professions, and students are not able to go on certainly in most cases even into secondary education, much less to college or to get professional degrees. And this matters a great deal. I also think it's important to realize in this crisis in Europe that we're not just talking about Syrians. About half the people going to Europe now are from Syria, but that leaves, you know, another 50% people who are coming from Eritrea, from Afghanistan, from Somalia, from West Africa, and many of them also have valid refugee claims, particularly the Eritreans almost always get asylum in Europe when they apply. The Afghans and Somalis have very high rates. They're coming from active war zones. So although Syrians are getting most of the attention, and rightly so, they're not the only people involved.
So we've talked about Germany. The United Kingdom has started to take in the first of 20,000. It's pledged to shelter through 2020. The question is, what more can the U.S. do? And Jonah Eaton, a main stumbling block here seems to be a fear of importing terrorism.
Yes, I think that is probably the main stumbling block. Well, it's that fear that has sort of been translated into sort of translated into bureaucracy at this point, you know, into sort of like the hurdles that individuals, you know, have to clear before they can come here to the United States. And I just want to real quick sort of be hopefully not too lawyerly, but sort of just draw, I think, an important distinction between an asylum seeker and a resettled refugee. So both of these groups, they have to meet the same – there's an international definition of refugee from the 1951 Refugee Convention that, you know, you're a person with a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, political opinion, and you have to be outside of your country of nationality, and you can't go back because you're afraid. So it's a surrogate protection regime. It's like you are being – you're at risk in your home country, and you go somewhere else for protection. If you're an asylum applicant, it means that you came here to the U.S. or you went to Germany or you went to wherever sort of on your own steam, and you're asking to be recognized as a refugee and granted protection. In terms of like the 120,000 number that we're talking about in Europe and the 100,000 that we're eventually going to get to here in the U.S., those are going to be resettled refugees. So those are people who have already been determined to have met the international definition, you know, outside of the country, you know, in usually in one of the refugee camps, have been referred to the United States government or an EU government or whomever, and then sort of cleared to come and settle here as a refugee.
The bottom line is it sounds as if it's such a cumbersome problem, and there is such an immediate need.
Yes, and so that's where the announcements coming out of the State Department are great, but I think there's still a worry that the security background check process is taking so long that it's not going to be a very immediate. I don't think we're going to see an immediate effect.
We're going to get your views on this, Kathleen Newland, in just a moment. Good. We've got to take a break. The U.S. Role in the cumbersome process. Lines are open, 888-477-9499. Or send us an email if you'd like to join the conversation, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at @whyyradiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. More of Radio Times coming right up. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. As thousands of Syrian migrants continue to make their way through Europe, we're examining the U.S. role in the refugee crisis. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number to call. Email radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet works as well at @whyy. Radio Times. And Kathleen, I was going to go to you as we were heading into the break. The question is, what more can and should the U.S. do here as far as accepting refugees?
Well, we can accept a great many more than we are accepting at the moment for resettlement. And again, these are people who have been chosen by the U.S., who have been through multiple layers of screening. Their biometric data will have been checked against databases by the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, national intelligence agencies. This is a low-risk population by the time they get here. And the record is that most of them have turned out to be very productive U.S. citizens, you know, from Albert Einstein to Google co-founder Sergey Brin. Refugees are often giving back much more to this country than they take.
So several years ago, I'm sorry for jumping in, but there were two Kentucky residents who'd been resettled as Iraqi refugees. They were convicted of terrorism charges after their fingerprints were linked to roadside bombs in Iraq. Since then, have the procedures been tightened up in terms of weeding out potential terrorists?
Well, I think the story of those two in Kentucky shows how well the system works, in fact. The procedures for admitting refugees were tightened up very much after September 11th, 2001. And in those 14 years, the U.S. has resettled 784,000 refugees through our refugee program. And those two in Kentucky were the only ones who have been arrested for planning terrorist activities. They were not planning an attack in the United States, and they were apprehended before they could carry out their plans. One of them is now serving a life sentence, and the other 40-year sentence. So our system, our intelligence agencies, our security screening system works, and in my view, that should be a cause for not complacency, but certainly for confidence in the security screening that we put refugees through, which is one of the reasons why the process takes so long. I feel certain it could be streamlined without increasing the risk. And if we are going to do our part for Syrian refugees, that is exactly what happened. We've done it before. In 1999, when we decided on very short notice to resettle 20,000 Kosovar refugees, we took them initially to military bases, to Fort Dix in New Jersey. Sure. We even flew some to Guam, where they could be safe. They could stay, and they could go through the procedures that were needed to make sure that they were not going to be a risk to the United States.
Kathleen, many of them did not have family here. They were starting from scratch. Do we know what's become of them?
They were distributed around the United States, put in touch with voluntary agencies that work on a national basis to help refugees resettle and become economically self-sufficient in the shortest time possible. That's a real key tenet of the federal refugee resettlement program. They only get federal assistance for 7 or 8 months, and they are expected to take a job, any job, and the voluntary agencies help them to find those jobs, hopefully jobs that are family, that pay a family wage and carry health care and so on. But the overwhelming emphasis is on early self-sufficiency. And the record for refugee populations in this country is really quite good, especially over time. You know, if you look at a group like the Vietnamese, they have a higher median family income than U.S. residents as a whole. And many refugee, half of the refugees who are resettled here have college degrees. It varies by national origin group, depending on what kind of background and opportunities they have had. But generally speaking, resettlement in this country is a very considerable success story.
Let's bring Congress and funding into the conversation. Congress does have to approve money for additional resettlement efforts. We're looking at a possible federal government shutdown October 1st if a stopgap spending bill isn't approved before then. And it's been estimated that resettling an extra 15,000 refugees could cost at least $200 million. So, Jonah Eaton, do you think there is the political will at this junction to approve this funding?
I mean, I will be curious to see. I don't really know what the answer to that. I mean, I think even, you know, on both sides of the aisle, I think there's a recognition that, you know, this is a catastrophe and that there should be some response and that, you know, this is the most tangible way in which we can respond.
Well, let me backtrack just a moment. It's a Republican-led Congress, obviously, and more Republicans have expressed concern that some of these refugees could come into this country and bring, you know, terrorist links with them. Michael McCaul has said ISIS wants to use refugee routes as a cover to sneak operatives into the West.
Yeah, I mean, I think well, so here I want to be clear. These are my opinions and don't reflect the opinions of the National ICE Service Center.
Sure.
I think that if you're ISIS or al-Nusra or an al-Qaeda affiliate and you want to try to get people here into the U.S., the refugee resettlement system is just a really stupid way to go about it. And these guys are fanatics, but I don't think they're idiots. You know, if you just look at the numbers, right, there's about 4 million and growing is the Syrian refugee population right now outside of Syria. By 2017, we're talking about a total, resettled population in the U.S. of 100,000, you know, if we even meet those numbers. Let's just say, to keep the math simple, every one of those 100,000 is a randomly selected Syrian. Of the total refugee population, that's a 0.025%, right? I mean, it's a minuscule part. So if you're trying to seed, you know, sort of fighters into the just the odds are so far against you. I mean, if you want to worry about ISIS, worry about, you know, ISIS members with European passports who can just come here on a visa waiver already. But to think that they're going to make their way through the refugee resettlement process, I think is sort of deeply misguided.
Kathleen Newland, do you think Congress will see it Jonah's way when it comes time to funding this?
You know, the refugee program has always been has had bipartisan support in Congress. We've had several Republican senators speaking out in favor of doing more for Syrian refugees. So I am hopeful. I think there is a faction in Congress, perhaps all of them in the Republican Party, who are resistant to immigration in any form. And I think that this is sort of part of that syndrome rather than something really aimed at refugees per se. But, of course, refugees are extremely vulnerable and could be the ones most affected by this. So I'm hopeful that, that the humanitarian leadership of the United States, which is a great part of our political tradition, will triumph over those voices of fear and exclusion. It's a political season, and it's by no means certain that will happen.
All right, the calls are starting.
I think the money is not the real
issue. And also I'd like to add that $200 million, I mean, most of that money is not like, you know, writing checks to the refugees, right? Like most of that money is the processing and the security checks and all that stuff. Sure. So like my organization is a refugee resettlement organization. So we get, some money from the government every year to help, you know, new refugee populations get acclimatized. But that's a very small, you know, slice of the pie. These people are expected to get on their feet very quickly.
And quickly, before we get to the calls, when you are resettling a refugee, what are you giving the family to get them started, Jonah?
I mean, you know, it's very basic sort of social work stuff, right? I mean, so it's like we, you know, our refugee resettlement unit, and again, I'm on sort of the legal side of things, so I'm mostly in immigration court, but the refugee resettlement group, I mean, they help people just find houses. I mean, they sort of have literally lists of rentals that, you know, they can refer refugees to. They try to help them find, you know, basic jobs just so they can get on their feet. Get the kids into school, social security numbers, just kind of all the stuff to help them sort of acclimatize and sort of, you know, to adjust to life in America.
Right.
And
for
there's a great...
Sorry, go ahead, go ahead.
I was going to recommend to your listeners a movie that I think portrays this really, really well, a Reese Witherspoon vehicle called The Good Lie. She produced it and also stars in it. And it's about a group of Sudanese lost boys who resettled in the U.S. And I think it provides a very good picture of how the process works and what kind of people are involved in it, who are, you know, ordinary Americans who are,
I've got about 30 Syrian clients, and you know they are, you know, overwhelmingly asylum seekers, and they're. I've got animators, graphic designers. I've got a PhD student. I mean, I've got, you know, these are well-educated professional people who want to, you know, build a new life here.
Let's get our listeners in on the conversation. Anne in Newark, Delaware. Welcome to Radio Times. Hi, Anne.
Hi, I hope you can hear me okay. I'm in the car.
Okay.
Thank you for taking my question. In thinking about the 100,000 who are eventually going to be resettled in the U.S., I wonder if, although I know the focus is Syrians, if any thought is being given to the many hundreds of Iraqis and their families who served with the U.S. and helped the U.S. during the war. They're in extreme danger, many of them. Many of them have already been approved, and yet they have not been given the opportunity yet to come to the U.S.
Good question, Ann. Thanks for the call. Jonah?
Yeah, so I think that's a good point. That actually sort of doubles back to my previous concern about the amount of time the security background checks are taking. Is that so what the caller is referring to is the special immigrant visa status, which is something we set up for Iraqis and Afghans who worked with the U.S. forces. And I forget the exact numbers, but basically there have been more visas available every year, and there are plenty of people applying for them. But again, sort of the backlog is such in terms of the background checking, that they haven't even been giving out all the available visas.
And I'd like to make clear that the additional numbers of Syrian refugees will not be taking numbers away from other nationalities.
Yeah.
We have been resettling 70,000 refugees a year for the last few years. The State Department is proposing to raise that to 85,000, so an additional 15,000. They've only said so far 10,000 Syrian refugees. So there will be additional numbers for Iraqis, for Sudanese, for other nationalities. So the Syrian program won't be taking that away and may indeed be creating additional opportunities for other refugees. Iraqis are already, I think, the third largest group that we've been settling in the last few years. And I think that more and more of them will be coming through that security pipeline, although it's still far too slow.
Yeah.
Continuing with our calls here on Radio Times, let's go to Colby in Satterton. Hello, Colby.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well, thanks. What's your question?
I have an interesting connection with all of this. A friend of mine who graduated from Kutztown University is currently a doctoral student from Tulane University is in Macedonia right now. He's on a Fulbright scholarship. He's on his own time, has been working with a refugee camp on the Macedonian border. And he just got word from the State Department that he has to leave the country. He was told that he has to resign his teaching position and that he has to leave because the State Department will not support what he's doing. Now, again, this is him doing it on his own time. He's working with an NGO, and he even started a GoFundMe project. And he's been using that money directly with the refugees. He's been spending time in the camps, helping refugees get what they need, get where they need to get to.
So, Colby, because we're up against the clock, the question is, why would the U.S. ask him to leave when he's helping?
That would be the question. Why would the State Department jump in on this person who's actually trying to help and say, no, you have to get out?
All right. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Kathleen Newland, any ideas as to why?
The only thing I can imagine, and I think it's really a shame, the situation the caller described is that he's not fulfilling the terms of his contract with the U.S. government, which is to be a scholar on the Fulbright program. In that sense, if he's not doing what he's there to do, the U.S. government has no obligation to support him for doing something else. Although I wish they would, but perhaps not through the Fulbright program.
What do you think, Jonah?
Yeah, I'm afraid I got no idea what the Fulbright rules are, so I can't comment.
Fair enough. Secretary of State Kerry has said that ultimately, to end the migrant crisis, you need to end Syria's civil war, and that likely means replacing President Bashar al-Assad. What do you think, Kathleen Newland?
Well, obviously, that's going to solve, say, 50% of the migrant crisis, although Syria is so destroyed that it's, people may continue to leave. It's not at all clear what what kind of government would succeed the Assad regime. And, if it's an Islamic fundamentalist government, you can see many more religious minorities trying to flee Syria.
Well, that was the follow-up.
That's already happening to an extent.
If the Assad regime fails, does that leave a vacuum for ISIS to fill?
Hello, Libya. Hello, Iraq. it's very uncertain what would happen there. There's so many conflicting interests and geopolitical interests, with, you know, Iran having an interest, Russia having an interest, Turkey having a big stake in what happens next door in Syria, being a leading opponent of Assad. So the fall of Assad is not going to solve the problem overnight. A stable Syria and under a more sort of inclusive government would solve the problem. But nobody should be looking for miracles here that are going to stop the flows, you know, on a dime. And even if it did, you would still have that other 50% of refugees who are coming to Europe from Eritrea and Afghanistan and Somalia and Mali and Central African Republic and northern Nigeria, all places that are war-torn and in severe political conflict.
Jonah, what's your
take? So they have to have a system.
Yeah. I think I completely agree with that. I mean, you know, Afghanistan has been more or less at war since the late 80s and has been a refugee-producing country almost the entire time. I think prognosticating is sort of impossible. I mean, you know, if Assad goes, you know, maybe ISIS fills that void, maybe it doesn't. I mean, personally, I think that sort of the ISIS political program is sort of very fundamentally unsustainable. I mean, their sort of entire kind of worldview is based on conquering, holding, and administering territory, but in this sort of, you know, with this brutal kind of 10th century gloss over it. And I don't think you can actually sustainably run a modern state that way. So I sort of feel like, you know, ISIS is going to burn itself out at some point. But that's just my opinion. I just have no idea. I just have no idea.
Especially in Syria. I mean, the Syrians are not, not fundamentalists. They're, you know, it's an ancient culture. It's a real civilization. And I think most of the ISIS fighters are not even Syrian.
Yeah.
So,
I have to jump in because we're just up against the clock here. That does wrap up our time spent with Kathleen Newland and Jonah Eaton. Thank you so much for joining us. Kathleen,
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Kathleen is Senior Fellow and Co-Founder of the Migration Policy Institute. Jonah is a staff attorney at the Nationality Service Center in Philadelphia, where he specializes in asylum issues. And after the break, the U.S. and Russia are eyeing each other over each other's country's involvement, each country's involvement in the Syrian conflict. We're going to talk about that coming right up. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowane. As we continue our look at the Syrian migrant crisis, we're going to take a few moments to examine the ongoing civil war in Syria and the involvement by Russia, the U.S., and Israel. We're joined by Brookings Fellow Jeremy Shapiro. He is editor of the Foreign Policy Programs blog Order from Chaos. Jeremy, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start off with your take on Secretary of State Kerry's view that to end this crisis, Syria's civil war needs to end, and that should involve replacing President Bashar al-Assad. What do you think, and what would be the consequences if the Assad regime were to fail?
Well, look, the Assad regime is definitely part of the problem in Syria, actually probably the major part of the problem. It certainly started the civil war, and it's certainly responsible for its escalation. It's killed many more people than any other faction in the war, and it bears the lion's share of the burden for the refugee crisis. But, you know, the problem that we face, as we faced in so many other similar situations, is that just because that's true doesn't mean that getting rid of the Assad regime would solve the problem or even make it better. At this point, the country has descended into quite a bit of chaos. There are many, many factions, and most importantly, those factions are all backed by various external sponsors who will simply escalate if their side seems to be in trouble, and that's what we've seen with the Russians recently. So
yes,
we could conceivably get rid of the Assad regime. We'd have to take on Russia and Iran to do it, and even if we did, it's not clear at all why the country would be any more stable after it happened.
Well, Jeremy, Russia supports the brutal Assad regime. Why is that?
I think that there are several, let's say, overlapping reasons why Russia supports the Assad regime. I think, first of all, they're not as concerned as we are about their brutality, which is the sort of moral element is just missing, I think. But secondly, and more importantly, they see the Assad regime as critical to opposing the Islamist forces in Syria, ISIS, but also other Islamist forces that are backed by the U.S. and U.S. or at least U.S. allies. And so they believe that the U.S. strategy for defeating ISIS makes no sense because it doesn't take advantage of the most effective anti-ISIS force in Syria, which is Assad. I think also very important for the Russians is this sort of notion of that they get to be part of the deciders in a crisis like Syria, and that they not allow the U.S. and its allies to overthrow an existing regime. That's a sort of important principled point of international relations for them, and it's important because they feel as if it threatens countries in their neighborhood like Ukraine and ultimately even Russia itself.
Jeremy Shapiro, according to some media reports, Russia has started to fly drones on surveillance missions in Syria, and there are signs Moscow is getting ready to inject Russian forces into Syria's civil war. What are your observations and conclusions?
It seems that Russia has injected forces into Syria. It seems that there are already some combat aircraft there and a fair amount of soldiers, somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 to 1500 that are there to protect the fighters, the aircraft at the very least. I think there's still some question as to what they really plan to do with those forces. Just their presence is a sort of warning to the West not to escalate and not to overthrow the Assad regime and to come around to the Russian point of view that Assad needs to be part of the anti-ISIS and the solution and part of the solution for stabilizing Syria. I think that there's some possibility, a good possibility, that they might use some of those forces for air attacks against either ISIS or other parts of the anti-Assad opposition. What I don't think is that those forces will in and of themselves make any really serious military difference in the Syrian civil war.
So clarify then, is there increasing concern in Russia that the Assad regime could collapse?
I think I read into this some concern that the Assad regime was slowly degrading, that the trends were not good. And certainly we've seen in the past several months, the Assad regime suffered some serious reversals in Idlib province, in Palmyra versus ISIS. And we've seen ISIS beginning to sort of infiltrate through central Syria and even into the suburbs of Damascus. There have been a lot of ups and downs in the Syrian civil war. And typically what we see is when one faction seems to be on the ropes, their external sponsors step up and support them enough to make them not fall. So I think this is a similar episode like that, but it does reflect the fact that the Assad regime has some long-term weaknesses, which are beginning to tell principally in their lack of manpower.
U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter has discussed the buildup with his Russian counterpart, Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu, to clarify any possible involvement. Did Mr. Carter come away with anything tangible in those discussions?
Well, I don't know. I wasn't privy to them. I keep asking, but no one tells me. I think that.
Well, what do you think happened?
Yeah, sure. In the very first instance, I think that it's absolutely necessary from a just sort of purely military technical standpoint to create some procedures for deconfliction. Because, let's face it, these two sides do not want to be shooting at each other, at least not by accident. At the moment, there's a risk that they will be sharing some very small airspace. And if they don't coordinate, the risks of accidents or tragedies is pretty severe, and the consequences of those are even more severe. So I think that that's at the very minimum what they did. I think that this is part of the Russian effort. As I said, this Russian effort this escalation is in part an effort to bring the United States around to their position that Assad needs to be part of the solution. And to do so from a position of strength. So I think that this outreach to Secretary Carter will, because it has to take place from a military technical standpoint, will also contain elements of trying to push the United States in that direction.
It does seem.
But I doubt they got anything on that front.
It does seem as if Secretary of State John Kerry has perhaps been a little more accepting of the possibility that Assad needs to be part of the solution. Is that an accurate take?
I think
of recent events.
I think it's sort of reasonable. I think that the parsing of this is very complicated. We had an agreement. The United States had an agreement with Russia. Back in June of 2012, that was codified in the Geneva communique, which said, which was one of those sort of artful diplomatic compromises, which essentially said, we're going to form a transition government, and the two sides will have to agree on who's in that transition government. So they'll both have veto over each other's choices. And to the United States, that meant that Assad would go at some point in the process because the opposition would never select him. At the news conference following that, the agreement on that communique, the Russians and Americans came out with very different interpretations of what it meant.
Hmm.
And so so the Russian and American compromise literally lasted about an hour and broke down immediately thereafter. And so I think it's going to be very difficult with that background to actually figure out what people mean. I think what Secretary Kerry has been trying to say is we don't need Assad to leave on the first day that we negotiate with him, but we need him to we need his departure to be a guaranteed part of the process. That's sort of been the long-standing American policy, although I think it's not been well understood in the press, which has just been about, you know, Assad must go or Assad must not go.
Yeah. The U.S. and Russia share a common enemy in the Islamic State. What are the commonalities in each respective country's plan of attack against ISIS?
Yeah, I think that this is a fundamental difference. There is no commonality, really, in their plan of attack against ISIS. For Russia, which sees this in more realist terms, the way to combat ISIS is to find ISIS's other enemies, which are basically everyone, and get them to fight with Russia against ISIS. And that means principally, because in Russia's view, the most effective anti-ISIS forces in the region are Iran, Hezbollah, and the Syrian regime. The United States says, you know, no, we are going to fight ISIS with a coalition of like-minded allies, and we're not going to make deals with the devil to fight ISIS. It's not worth it. And so we're actually going to fight both of these civil wars at the same time and kind of separately. And that the Russians believe that that is crazy.
Speaking of Hezbollah, Israel is concerned that Russian weapons could eventually end up with Hezbollah. Is Israel right to be uneasy?
Yeah, I think that Israel is right to be uneasy. It's very likely, if you sort of look at the way that the Russian military doctrine tends to work, that when these forces are deployed in Latakia, they will be accompanied by air defense systems, possibly even the S-300 air defense system, which is a very sophisticated and advanced air defense system, and which the Israelis have been very keen to keep out of Iranian hands and to keep out of Syrian and Hezbollah hands. And just the presence of that system, even if it's owned and operated by the Russians, will mean that the Israelis will have much more difficulty gaining air access to Lebanon and to Syria. And they have occasionally, not all that frequently, but at critical points in the last couple of years, they have bombed convoys going into Lebanon from Syria, which they claimed were advanced weapons being transferred to Hezbollah. And just the presence of the Russians could deny them the capability to do that.
Russian President Vladimir Putin met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday. Jeremy Shapiro, I know you were not a fly on the wall of that meeting, but what, if anything, have you been able to parse from any information that came out of that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that, you know, the Russians and the Israelis have a pretty good relationship. I don't think it is the intent of the Russian deployment to create these types of problems for Israel. It's a side effect that they have to deal with. The Israelis have been very active here in Washington in pointing this out and in getting the United States to be bringing this up with the Russians. And I'm sure that the Israelis did it directly. My guess would be, it's only a guess, that the Russians and the Israelis will find a modus vivendi here, because it's not the intent of the deployment.
Let's get back to unintended conflict. If military actions are not coordinated between the various countries involved, the U.S., Russia, Israel, what are the odds that unintended conflict will occur, do you think? And you'd alluded to consequences a little bit earlier in our conversation. So if they're not coordinated military actions, are the odds pretty good that that something untoward would happen?
I think that the conversations we've seen between the Russians and the Israelis and between the U.S. and the Russians are indications that all sides recognize the danger and the consequences of that and will establish deconfliction procedures. And as long as they're doing that, I think that the chances of accidental conflict are pretty low.
If something does happen, though, what would the consequences be, do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think that in that case, it really depends on the political context. I think if neither side is interested in escalation, there won't be escalation. But I would be very worried in that particular case that that not exactly the U.S. and the Russians, but the Russians and various U.S. proxies, people who are supported by Saudi Arabia and Turkey, and even by the U.S. directly, could get into direct struggles with the Russians. And so we would be in a situation like we were very often in the Cold War, where the U.S. and Russia weren't really fighting each other directly, but they were essentially arming each other's opponents, and Russian and or American soldiers were dying as a result.
I know I'm doing this kind of backwards, but let's go back 4 years to the Arab Spring. It set the table for us when the civil war in Syria started. Could you give us a brief sketch of that time?
Sure. It's been a long and tortured road, but
yeah.
The Syrian civil war, I guess, I mean, if you will, at least the precursor of it, started in roughly March 2011, and it was a series of sort of Arab Spring-like demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations, but quite large and quite threatening to the Assad regime. If you recall, at that period, such things had already happened in Egypt and in Tunisia and in Libya. And in the first two cases, the dictators had chosen a path of not escalating to violence, really, except in sort of minor ways, but had quite quickly been overthrown.
Hey, Jeremy, I asked you a long question when we didn't have a whole lot of time.
Oh,
we've got about 10
sorry.
Seconds to wrap up. Sorry about that.
No problem. I'm sorry to go on.
No, it's been interesting. I wish we had more time.
The key point to take from that is that the Assad regime felt the need to escalate to violence because it couldn't survive without it.
Okay. Jeremy Shapiro, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
A Brookings Fellow, Jeremy is editor of the Foreign Policy Program's blog, Order from Chaos. And this reminder, you can find our Facebook page and podcasts at whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. Hour two is just ahead. Stay with us.